ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Report with me, Norman Swan, on Gadigal land.
And me, Tegan Taylor, on Jagera and Turrbal land. Norman, I'm really looking forward to chatting about something that you've been looking into this week, which is kind of the ultra-processed foods being sold to parents to give to their toddlers, which, as someone who has been in charge of keeping toddlers fed, I know is an absolute minefield. There's so many colourful packages. Everything promises to be so healthy, and I know you're going to tell me it's all a big lie.
I can certainly say that no toddler milk is recommended. What is recommended for toddlers is a varied, wholesome, nutritious diet.
And some stats to make you think before you pour that glass of wine tonight.
But first, Norman, I do want to talk to you about some of the things that have been in the health news ecosystem this week, one of which is a new report from the Australian Institute on Health and Welfare about injuries caused by animals, showing that they're on the increase. And I shouldn't laugh about it because some of these injuries are quite serious, but some of them are kind of funny.
Well, I suppose they are. It's interesting. Yeah, they have gone up. These are emergency department statistics over 10 years. I didn't realise that 40% of households had a dog. So pets, you're 6.6 times more likely to get an injury from a non-venomous animal than a venomous one in Australia. You know, if you were doing this overseas, people would think it's all...
Yeah, snakes and spiders.
Snakes and spiders, but in fact, it's boring stuff. So it's agricultural animal injuries. We're more exposed to the natural environment. It's pets. Interestingly, in South Australia, it's bee anaphylaxis. You know, we talk about venom, it's bee anaphylaxis. In Queensland, it's snakes. And in Tasmania, it's jack jumper ant anaphylaxis.
Oh, gosh.
Venomous problem there.
I mean, I did actually literally have a snake in my vegetable patch this morning. One of the categories that really tickled me for some reason was, the wording is always funny, bitten or crushed by other reptiles, that is not venomous snakes or lizards, nearly 2,000 cases. I know that you had a pet tortoise when you were a wee boy. Did it ever bite or crush you?
No, Speedy was too fast, really.
Speedy.
You could never get Speedy. Talking about anomalous, whatever the word is, animal names, I was looking after a friend's farm over Christmas once, and they had horses, and one of the horses' names was Dozy. And on Boxing Day, I decided to brush off the cobwebs by saddling up Dozy and going for a ride. And I egged Dozy on into a canter and basically fell off.
That doesn't sound like it was Dozy's fault, Norman.
Dozy stopped, and because I'd done everything wrong, looking at everything, and I had this searing pain across my back and a crushed vertebrae.
Ooh.
But anyway, the interesting corollary to the story is that this wasn't my friend's horse. It was another friend down the road who was a paediatrician who kept horses. And when she heard the story, her question was, how's the horse?
Classic horse person response.
That's right. So horses are not safe.
Into a little bit more serious health news, Norman. You and me have spoken a lot about COVID over the last 4 years. We had a whole podcast about it. And one of the things that came out relatively quickly after the beginning of the pandemic was this sense that a lot of people didn't just bounce back after they were infected by coronavirus. They developed something that we've kind of now sort of colloquially call long COVID. There's a group of researchers who have sort of come out in the last day or two saying that they think it's time to move past this term long COVID because they say it's basically indistinguishable from other post-viral syndromes a year after infection.
Yes, this was an embargoed press release that came out a couple of days ago from a infectious disease conference in Spain. And what they were quoting was research from Queensland Health, where they claim to have compared people with COVID PCRs, positive PCRs, to influenza and followed them through. They started off with 19,000 people, I think ended up with 3,000 or 4,000 people that they followed through for 12 weeks and claimed there was no difference between the two groups, and claiming that basically what's all this fuss about COVID, it's no worse than flu, which goes along a little bit with Queensland. They've now for some time, I suppose you could say, minimise the effect of COVID. There was a period where Queensland health authorities were saying we should open up Queensland and just let everybody become infected. So there is a bit of a track record here. And just to give you perspective of what's going on here. Let's assume for a moment that their assumption in this paper is right, that there is no difference effectively between the long-term effects of an influenza infection to a COVID-19 infection. Even if that's true, the dimensions of SARS-CoV-2 in terms of the number of infections in Australia and the proportion of people who actually get persistent symptoms, COVID has an enormous public health impact compared to influenza. Even if comparing one person to another, there is no difference between the two, which is what the assertion is in this research, which is that there's no difference between the two. But in a public health and population impacts sense, COVID is vastly more toxic than flu simply because of numbers. But then there was a study published in Lancet Infectious Diseases towards the end of last year. Compared to about 3,000 people, they had 81,000 people, where it wasn't a selected population. It was studying the medical records of many, many thousands of people and showing that there was no equivalence really between COVID and flu. COVID was much worse. So comparing COVID with flu, COVID was more toxic, you're more likely to die, you're more likely to be in hospital, you're more likely to have long-term effects than flu. So COVID was worse than flu. And that was in a vaccinated period, the same as this was in a vaccinated period. So you're comparing, you know, this was in an Omicron world. So I think that even if you accept the premise of this paper, on a numbers game, COVID is much worse. And if you accept the data based on a much larger, less selective study, I mean, the patients were less selected, it was more population-based, COVID, long COVID symptoms are in fact worse. And also the Queensland study contradicted the Victorian study that you and I covered last year, which is a much more population-based survey in Victoria, which showed really quite high levels of long COVID symptoms in the community.
So what are the implications of this train of thought, though, of kind of going, well, it's sort of not indistinguishable from other illnesses? Like, I know that for people who have long COVID, it's incredibly isolating, incredibly hard. But then there's also a big group of people who have syndromes that are very much like long COVID, other perhaps post-viral syndromes, things like myalgic encephalitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, that kind of wish that they could have the attention that long COVID sufferers have had. Is putting them all together kind of a good thing or a bad thing when it comes to actually helping patients?
Well, what would be a good thing in a sense, but it's wishful thinking, is that it's exactly the same syndrome as, say, myalgic encephalomyelitis. And there are lots of similarities, and there may well be fundamental similarities at a biological level. So in a sense, long COVID or persistent symptoms after an acute COVID infection does help people with myalgic encephalomyelitis because there's lots of research going on into finding out what's going on. And the hope is that it's applicable to chronic fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalomyelitis. So I think in a sense, people are going to be helped by that. The thing is also, you've got very large numbers of people who've got persistent symptoms after COVID-19, therefore more accessible to study. You're right, people do feel a bit left behind who've got myalgic encephalomyelitis, but hopefully there are solutions that are found or reasons found which are applicable across the board. Not all myalgic encephalomyelitis...
It's such a mouthful, I got it wrong before as well.
Let's call it chronic fatigue syndrome. Not all people with that have a clear line to a viral infection. Lots of viral infections produce fatigue over an extended period of time and you feel the viral symptoms coming back. But chronic fatigue syndrome is very different from that. And it's also, those post-viral syndromes are also very different from persistent SARS-CoV-2 symptoms, which are much more likely to be multi-system, affecting different parts of your body, your brain, your lungs, etc. Whereas it looks as though post-flu, a lot of it is actually lung effects rather than others. So there are differences. It's an incredibly complicated area and lots of desperate people with all these conditions who need help.
Yeah. Is there any sense that this particular paper out of Queensland is going to change policy, or is it sort of just in the mix at the moment?
These data have been out for a while and I'm not sure it's changed things much, But there is a tendency, both at the federal level and at state level, to try and normalise COVID-19 in the sense that it is just like the flu. It's never been like the flu.
Mm. So to a bit more news, Norman, something that you've been working on throughout this week. You did a story earlier in the week after 7:30 on what are called toddler milks. And I really want to talk about it because it kind of plays into a much bigger issue around the things that are marketed to toddlers in general.
Yeah, major problems with toddler foods in general, which we'll come to in a moment with one of the people who have been really advocating in this area.
But yes, let us start with toddler milks. A definition, please, because it's quite different to like infant formula.
Yes. Well, although if you're in one of the corporate chemists or you're in a supermarket and you look along in the row, I challenge you to separate the toddler formula from the infant formula. Essentially, what we're talking about, well, in context, what we're talking about is the first 1,000 days of life. And nutrition and development...
Help me with my maths, Norman. Are we talking...
Well, it's the first 3 years of life. So toddlerhood is from about 12 months to about 3 years of age. That's the definition. Nutrition is part of, obviously, growth of your brain, growth of your body, setting down healthy patterns in your metabolism, but it's also about development. I'll come back to that in a moment. So this is about the early years. And toddler milk is powdered milk. It's an ultra-processed food that's packaged in a tin that's pretty much identical to an infant formula tin. And it's marketed as either transition or follow-on formula from the age of 12 months if you're from breastfeeding or from infant formula to other powdered milk formulae. And it's heavily marketed and the market is growing fast. One in three Australian toddlers, according to research at Deakin University, are consuming toddler milk. And here's one example of marketing using parents.
We're both busy parents, we're both working parents, and that's why we choose Aptamil Gold Plus Toddler's Milk for Little Rosie.
Aptamil Gold Plus Toddler is a trusted brand by parents like us, and it is the number one recommended brand by paediatricians.
Both of us have been really happy with the Aptamil Gold Plus Toddler's Milk. It has prebiotics, probiotics and omega-3, and it keeps Rosie nice and healthy and happy.
It's super easy to make and Rosie absolutely loves it.
A lot of the time she's been asking for more because she absolutely loves the taste.
Okay, so that definitely sounds, well, it actually sounds a little bit like a hostage video, but it definitely sounds like a health food. They're talking about prebiotics. They're saying it's recommended by paediatricians, all that sort of thing.
Well, number one, recommended paediatricians. We did ask Aptamil where they got that information from, and they say they've got a panel of paediatricians that they get this information from. And it's no wonder they love the taste because these milks, on average, are sweet. They're very sweet. If you compare them to cow's milk, which is a natural product, these are ultra-processed products, they've got twice the carbs and added sugars. Well, they're all added sugars compared to cow's milk. And if you compare the calories serve for serve on average in toddler milks, there are more calories serve for serve than in a popular brand of orange lemonade. Here's Jennifer McCann at Deakin University, who's researched toddler milks.
If a toddler was to consume, say, one serve, which is 200 mils, which is a recommended serve of toddler milk per day, toddlers would be consuming an extra 60 teaspoons of sugar per month than if they just had regular cow's milk. So that's a lot of sugar extra that they don't need.
I mean, I'm not sure kids need any extra sugar at all.
Well, they don't need toddler milks at all. There's no respected authority on child health, including the World Health Organization, which recommends toddler milks. They say that they're unnecessary. I interviewed a leading paediatrician at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, Anthea Rhodes, who's very worried about them.
I think the thing that makes me most angry about this is how parents are really being misled. Toddlers, so children aged between 1 and 3, need a wholesome family diet, regular food, water, and breast milk if they're still breastfeeding. And that's all. They certainly don't need toddler milk. And yet parents are being told that there's essential nutrients their child might miss out on. They're being told their development might not be as good if they don't have these products. Some of the advertising even suggests children will be more intelligent if they have toddler milks. And so parents, wanting to do the best by their kids, are thinking this is something we need to do.
It's a bit like we talked a few weeks ago on What's That Rash about multivitamins and that idea of kind of filling in the gaps of your diet just in case you're not getting it. And that idea as a parent is really tempting, especially if your kid is throwing like every food you offer them straight on the ground.
Well, that's right. I mean, here's the pattern of development, which you know only too well, which is you introduce solids and it all goes hunky-dory until the baby gets to about a year old. And then they start becoming very fussy. They'll chuck the food on the floor, et cetera, et cetera. And the temptation is to have a food fight and force it and so on. Toddlers are fussy eaters. And it's one of the frustrations of being a parent. And the data are that on average, to get a child, a toddler, to eat a new food, let's say broccoli or something like that, you've got to put it on their high chair 20 times before they start eating it. You don't force it on them. You just leave it there and they'll throw it on the floor and they'll throw it on the floor 20 times. Eventually, they will eat it. But parents think, oh God, if I passed a four nights in a row, you know, they're going to become malnourished. Well, they don't. But what Anthea Rhodes believes is that toddler milks are contributing to obesity. They're retarding a child's development because they're actually not sitting necessarily, if we're going to get a toddler milk rather than whole foods, they're not getting the tactile experience of food, they're not eating at the same time as the adults at the table. And she believes from her clinic experience that in the end, it can make fussy eating worse because the children are narrowing down. And then the other issue here is because the branding and presentation on the tins is identical to infant formula, Jennifer McCann at Deakin University believes it's a way these ultra-processed food manufacturers get round the voluntary ban on infant formula marketing.
On a toddler milk, you might have an image of an infant formula. But in its own right, infant formula is not allowed to be marketed in Australia under our agreements that we have, our voluntary agreements. The manufacturers can circumvent that, and it's almost like providing a segue for marketing of these infant formulas through the marketing on pack of toddler milks.
Also, it's not that they're only that you transition from infant formula into the toddler milks. It's that the toddler milks are being used to kind of retrospectively market infant formula.
Well, and talk about retrospectively, they're now marketing pregnancy formula. So that when you're pregnant, you take milk formula and its tin is also identical. So that you get to a brand, brand X, and you take it in pregnancy. And then when you go to the supermarket or the chemist, you see brand X as infant formula and brand X as toddler formula. They've got you for the next 4 years.
It sounds like an episode years. Of the Gruen transfer.
Well, it is a worry. What's needed, say the experts, is mandatory regulation of marketing. But Dr. Jennifer McCann is a bit despondent because the food industry is usually at the table when regulation is being discussed.
There's a lot of food industry and manufacturing influence in the government. And I think that we need to really separate that corporate influence coming into, you know, government policymaking. And research shows that they shouldn't be at the table. The industry needs to be separated from that those policy decisions and the policy table.
So toddler milks, your story is on 7:30. People can see that on iView. But that does kind of lead us to just ultra-processed foods for kids. They're really marketed as being healthy. They have fruit and vegetables on the front. They've got, you know, whole grains and they've got cartoon characters. And honestly, when my kids were toddlers, we did use them a fair bit because they're easy, especially when you are on the go and you're not sure what the options are going to be that are going to be suitable for your kid.
That's right. And it is an issue. We bellyache about childhood obesity, and for good reason. If you are obese and overweight when you hit adolescence, your hormones are reset and you're much more likely to become obese and overweight or stay that way as an adult. Now, Jane Martin is a public health advocate and researcher who's been working in this area for a long time, executive manager of Food for Health Alliance, which used to be the Obesity Alliance. One of the key aims of the Food for Health Alliance is to improve nutrition and prevent obesity, especially in children. Welcome to the Health Report, Jane.
Thanks, Norman.
So just Tegan did a pretty good job of defining toddler foods, but what are the range here we're talking about?
Well, there's hundreds of these packaged foods on the supermarket shelves, and it's certainly a growing category. And so that's why we really should be looking at this, because they are ultra-processed foods, and many of them don't meet, you know, nutrition guidelines set by organisations like the World Health Organization. We've looked at a lot of the products on the shelves. It's really important that children have good nutrition. As you said, those first 1,000 days when their brain is developing is critical. And families want nutritious food to provide to their children, but these products, the vast majority are not.
What's the public health impact? I mean, are enough of these foods being eaten by enough kids to create a problem?
Well, what we know about the market is that 82% of these foods for toddlers don't meet nutritional standards set by the World Health Organization. And particularly problematic are snacks, which are sold to toddlers, and they make up 2/3 of all products marketed to this age group. And the snack products, 96% fail the nutrition recommendations put up by the World Health Organization. And the reason that organizations like us are concerned about this is that for some children, packaged foods starting to make up a significant portion of toddlers' diets. Data from the Royal Children's Hospital shows that 2 in 5 Australian toddlers eat these foods for at least half of their diet. So that's a really serious problem when we have 80% of toddlers not eating enough vegetables and more than half exceeding the recommended sugar intakes. And a lot of these products are high in added sugar, and that's why toddlers will eat them and ask for more, because many of them are sweet.
The easiest thing here is to blame parents. Oh, you know, what slack parents to be giving them these foods. And of course, the easiest thing to do is to make parents feel guilty. They're already feeling guilty. Anthea Rhodes alluded to that in my 7:30 story. To what extent is this a parental problem versus market?
Well, we asked parents if they thought there should be any regulations, or thought there were regulations around the marketing and the claims on these foods. And 9 in 10 agreed that there should be laws on the images and claims allowed on baby and toddler foods. And 90% also agreed that there should be laws to limit harmful sugars and salt in baby foods. And they thought that these products were much more regulated than they in fact were. So parents are concerned about the nutrition and marketing claims on these packaged foods.
So they're being hoodwinked, in a sense, by the marketing. So they think it's going to be healthy, but in fact it's not.
No, that's right. And they're being hoodwinked as well with these marketing claims. We know that there's up to 15 claims on a single pack of toddler food. So this certainly has an influence on parents. And Cancer Council Victoria has done research that shows when these unhealthier toddler foods show these marketing claims, like free from preservatives, colours, flavours, it boosts parents' or carers' intentions to buy these products for toddlers to eat. So marketing works, and we're seeing many, many claims appearing on these products to give them a healthier halo than they would have, which is why it's recommended that no claims appear on these foods, and also that sugars aren't added to these foods. Some of these products have similar sugar levels to what you would find, or more than what you would find in a Smartie, for example.
And of course, that changes the taste preference of children, or could change the taste preference.
Yeah, absolutely. As you said before, these children are learning and setting habits very early in life. The preference for sweet, once that's set, is quite hard to shift. And yes, certainly it, you know, sets those preferences for sweetened foods.
We did the story for 7:30. We went to the Infant Nutrition Council to get a comment, and they basically said, well, we're talking about toddler milk, that these are supplementary. It should only be done with the advice of a medical practitioner, or as they followed the official line, in a sense. But of course, the food processing industry, these milk manufacturers, have not applied the voluntary ban on infant milk to toddler milk. So we're not even applying that to milk. What chance have you got of getting the industry to accept mandatory regulation? Because even infant milk formula marketing is a voluntary ban.
Yeah, look, it's really important that we have mandatory regulation that levels the playing field, so we're not seeing an early adopter or a...
So in other words, just to explain, sorry to interrupt, Jane, is that when you've got voluntary regulation, you'll get some manufacturers who do the right thing, but they're penalised because a lot of manufacturers don't do the right thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And these corporations on the whole are building their profits. So they're packing these products with cheap ingredients like sugars. And there's a lot of apple puree and apple paste in products that look savoury, but in fact have a higher proportion of those kinds of ingredients. So it's really important that parents get the information that they need and deserve, and that industry is supporting them. And that is by things like not having claims on products, not putting added sugar in these products, and that the names and the representations on the products actually represent the ingredients that are in them. So parents really can have an unfiltered view of what these products actually are.
Now, Jane, you once worked in tobacco control. It's been a long time since the tobacco industry has been allowed at the table to talk about tobacco control. They're never in the room. They might be trying to be lobbied from the side and visit ministers and so on, but they're never in the room when the actual regulations are. Jennifer McCann at Deakin University alleges that the food industry is often at the table when food regulation is being discussed. Where are we at in terms of moving forward on this?
Yeah, well, industry hasn't responded to these guidelines that are coming out around the nutrition and marketing around these foods. There is some movement by the Australian government, which has started to look at these products for babies and toddlers, which is, you know, really important. There's a paper that has been prepared looking at how these products are marketed and sold. And the food ministers around Australia and New Zealand have agreed that there are issues with these foods and have asked that options for policy reform be developed. And they've raised five key issues around these foods, including sugar and salt. But what is missing from the key issues is a focus on these snack foods, which toddlers clearly don't even need. We anticipate that there'll be consultation on policy options, that the food industry, particularly those companies that sell these products, will be putting their views. But it's important that, you know, we see these options and that government moves and looks to the evidence and the health impacts of these products in the marketplace and how they're undermining, in many cases, our children's health.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is you're super optimistic and 1 you're not optimistic at all of change, where do you sit?
Look, today I'm at 7 because...
What happened when you got up this morning, Jane? What was special about today?
Well, I was probably at a 5, but no, it's got better through the day because there are these policy options coming onto the table for the food ministers to consider. I think there's very, very high public concern around this. Parents rightly expect that these products are regulated and that they are nutritious and wholesome for their children. And we really need to see healthy products on the market. And, you know, this is a marketing opportunity, but it will be the regulation that will shift behaviour and shift the products to be more nutritious for our youngest Australians. They deserve that.
Jane, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll follow up with Jane later in the year to see what happens to those policy papers from the federal government. Jane Teagan is Executive Manager of Food for Health Alliance.
And I think that idea about regulation is so important because with this category, as with kind of any ultra-processed food, we've got at an individual level like this classic problem. They're shelf-stable, they're safe in a sense of food safety. Having the time to do something like slice up rock melon or make a whole grain sandwich before you leave the house really favours people with time and resources. And if we're talking about public health, the healthy option has to be a low effort option if we're going to make a difference, especially for people who are most in need.
Absolutely right.
You're with the Health Report.
And Tegan, you're looking into another unnecessary nutrient, alcohol.
Well, yes.
You can call it a nutrient.
Yeah, well, it's certainly something that we consume. And this is a bit more of a serious story because we know that drinking alcohol can lead to death, either because of something sudden and unexpected like a drink driving accident or a long-term thing like liver disease. But it looks like we might have actually been underestimating these deaths. And it has to do with something called the sick quitter effect, which I kind of like because it's catchy. Are you familiar with this term?
Absolutely. It used to be said there was a U-shaped curve where or a J-shaped curve, just imagine a J, where both sides of the curve were high risk and there was a sweet spot in the middle, maybe 2 or 3 drinks a day. And so you were at high risk because you drank no alcohol. So no alcohol was bad for you was the assumption, and high amounts of alcohol were bad for you. But there was something about that left-hand risk curve.
Yes, indeed. So what you often are finding when you're looking at people who drink no alcohol at all, they might not have never drunk alcohol at all. It could be that they don't drink because they're sick because of previous harm caused by alcohol.
Therefore, it's not the alcohol that's causing the increased risk of illness. It's the illness itself.
Correct. So we have actually known this for decades, but a new study has found that the majority of review studies still don't adjust for this phenomenon, which is still giving us a distorted view of alcohol's effects on our health. I've been chatting with lead author Peter Sarich.
Maybe a couple of decades ago, it was thought that perhaps alcohol might contribute to some protection against cardiovascular disease, mortality, and maybe some other conditions. But increasingly in recent years, that evidence has become a lot weaker. And that's actually part of what our study shows, is that over 70% of the reviews on alcohol harm published since 1993, over 70% of them use non-drinkers as the comparison group, which can cause biased results due to that sick quitter effect. And there's also evidence from other sources. There's something, there's a type of study called a Mendelian randomization study, which is based on genetic evidence around alcohol consumption and harms. And that type of study fails to find any protective effects. So it does appear, based on recent evidence, that this J-shaped curve, a large part of that could be due to those sorts of biases like the sick quitter effect.
So from a research perspective, what should we be doing differently if we want to understand the health risks of alcohol properly?
There's a few other person groups that can be used. So one is to examine those people who've never drank alcohol rather than just all non-drinkers combined, which includes former drinkers. So this is what's done with smoking, for example. In most of studies of smoking, never smokers are used as the comparison group when we're studying the health effects of people who currently smoke. So the same sort of thing can be done with alcohol as well. Looking at never drinkers, using those as the comparison group when researching the harms of drinking. Another idea is also to use sort of people who only drink on special occasions, who just drink occasionally, because those people are more likely, we think, to have sort of sociodemographic characteristics that are more similar to other drinkers. And so that is also probably a fair comparison group to use as well.
Right. So a never drinker maybe is more likely to be from very particular ethnic or religious groups, perhaps.
That's right. So there are socioeconomic differences between those who drink and those who never drink alcohol. There is increasingly evidence that those who have never drank also are more likely to have health conditions that might be causing them not to drink in the first place.
Sure.
And so that's why perhaps maybe those who drink on special occasions might be the best comparison group to use.
So this is very much about like how we crunch data. What does the everyday person take away from this research?
So I think this study is a timely reminder for Australians to follow the national health guidelines on alcohol. While there is no healthy amount of alcohol, the national guidelines state that Australian adults should drink no more than 10 standard drinks per week, with no more than 4 on any one day. And the less you drink, the lower your risk of harm from alcohol. 32% of us are actually exceeding this guideline, though. And even more concerning are the recent statistics from the ABS finding that alcohol-induced deaths in Australia have been increasing over the past 10 years. And of all deaths caused by alcohol in Australia, a large portion are actually from cancer. The more people drink, the higher their risk of dying from one of the several types of cancer that are caused by alcohol. And what many people don't know is that alcohol actually causes more cancer deaths each year than UV radiation. Yet awareness of the risks in Australia is low.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but if we're looking at deaths from alcohol, presumably we're focusing on people who have at some stage in their life drunk quite heavily. How does this research sit against our understanding of harms of alcohol at lower levels of consumption?
So the study shows that over 70% of previous reviews on alcohol and risk of death at lower levels of alcohol consumption may have been biased due to this sick quitter effect issue. So two of the reviews included in the study actually did compare what happens when you use non-drinkers as the comparison group compared to never drinkers as the comparison group. And both of them actually found the a parent's protection with light drink actually was overestimated or became non-significant when switching to using non-drinkers as the comparison group.
Right, so any kind of shadow of potential protection from light drinking kind of disappeared once they sort of corrected for that.
Yeah, it does seem to be substantially reduced, that's right.
What kind of surprised you as a researcher in this space when you started looking at it closely?
I think what surprised me was that the sip quitter issue was first written about in the 1980s, so it was sort of a bit concerning that most reviews, over 70%, did include ex-drinkers in the comparison group. And it means that the majority of reviews over the past 30 years may have underestimated the number of deaths that alcohol causes.
Has it changed your own relationship with alcohol, if you don't mind me asking?
I only drink alcohol sort of on special occasions. So
so you should be in the reference group for one of these studies, in other words?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
Given that you're saying that we've been underestimating the harm of alcohol for potentially 30 years, are our guidelines still fit for purpose if they're based on this evidence?
So I think you would never really base the guidelines just on one study. So every 10 years or so, the alcohol guidelines do get updated, and that's based on the review of all the evidence available at the time. So I guess we would like to see the sip quitter effect and the evidence generated from this study to be considered when the next time the guidelines are in development.
So that's Peter Sarich, who's a research fellow at the Daffodil Centre. And that chat really did get me thinking about, it feels to me at least, maybe it's just my algorithm serving me this, that I'm hearing a lot more about risks of drinking at much lower levels than probably that study's capturing.
Yeah. Look, essentially, it's a straight line. The more you drink, the more the risk. There's no safe level of alcohol use. Health Canada has just recommended no more than 2 drinks a week, aiming for zero. The Australian guidelines really, in essence, are pragmatic rather than necessarily being particularly evidence-based. And I think Peter was alluding to that.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how, when they're adjusted again within that 10-year time frame, if there is a big shift. I think it would be a really big cultural shift for Australia if there was.
Yeah, well, Canadians drink as well. But that's it for the Health Report for this week. If you want more, you should definitely check out our other podcast, What's That Rash?, where we're answering the health questions that everyone's asking.
And this week, it's the question that every teenager in history has ever asked. Why on earth do we get pimples?
You mean plucs, don't you?
Ugh, that word makes me want to honestly puke.
God, you're so squeamish. But we are answering your acne-related questions, and you've been sending in plenty of them. Just search What's That Rash in the ABC Listen app and hit that follow button while you're there so that you get every episode.
I promise they're not always this gross. Also, when you're in the podcasting neighbourhood, make sure you're following the Health Report too, and we'll see you next week.
We certainly shall.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.